class of 1998. And then attended graduate school at CMU and worked with Randy Couch on educational technology, educating people in computer science. And she now is an assistant professor in the computer science and engineering department at Washington University in St. Louis. And we're delighted to have her here. Her research interests are in human-computer interaction and computational learning environments. And she states that she's particularly interested in creating programming environments that engage a broad spectrum of children. So this is a very interesting topic for those of us in computer science and engineering, because we know we have insufficient numbers of students ready to come to college studying computing, so anything to engage children and get them interested in the creativity of computers is a wonderful thing.
Okay, thank you very much. Can everybody hear me if I talk like this, or do I need to be louder? It's good? All right. So I've spent a lot of time over the last few years really thinking about how we attract a broader spectrum of people into computer science, and specifically why it's important to do so. One of the ways I like to illustrate that is with this thought experiment. So I want you to start by imagining that tomorrow morning, all of the games, including sort of all of the sports and all of the board games and all of the video game consoles and everything that we do under the heading of sort of game entertainment, gone. Wiped out, the only thing left is soccer. I'm not actually a soccer player either. So the only thing left is soccer. And to try and recreate this rich space, we only have soccer players to do that. How many years is it going to take before we get back to Monopoly? Probably a very, very, very long time. And computer science has sort of done the same thing. We've got this relatively narrow spectrum of our population, both within this country and internationally, that is really involved in creating the technologies that the society as a whole uses. And so as we do that, you know, each of us tends to design things that are important to us that sort of match our perspective on, you know, life and the universe and how things work. And so when we do that, we may end up actually pushing society in some way that may be good, but may also have sort of long-term consequences that we're not seeing right now. And one of our best hedges against that is to make sure that we actually bring in a very, very broad spectrum of people and get a lot of them involved in building new things. Because then the things that they build can sort of, you know, one of the nice properties of computing is you can build something and propagate it to everybody very, very quickly. And so then we actually, as a society, will sort of tend to drift in a way that's more in line with what society as a whole wants. And we've seen sort of, you know, incidences where we actually create problems without wanting to. So a lot of the early speech systems were developed by, you know, this very passionate group of people who tested their system on the people in their lab. And at the end of the day, what they had was a system that worked on male voices with an accent from that region. And they didn't go into this process saying, I'm going to build a technology that excludes everyone who wasn't born here and anybody who's female. They built a system thinking, oh, we're going to make it so that anybody in the world can talk to anybody else with low cost and sort of, you know, involve more voices. And as a byproduct of the fact that they were operating in this very narrow space, they happened to create something that was actually excluding a lot of people. So that's sort of an obvious example. But I think there's actually the possibility of some much less obvious examples, you know, that we'll see 50 years down the road, 60 years down the road, of like, oh my goodness, what have we done? So how do we actually get a broader group of people into computer science? I'm going to sort of give a series of answers that represent sort of the progression of the project that we've been working on for a number of years now. And the very first piece, and a lot of people have gone after this particular one, is just to remove the frustration. There's a lot of, you know, syntax and garbage and so forth that's associated with the very beginning stages of computing, and it's frustrating for people, and they don't get very far, and then they come away with this impression that, you know, computer science is boring and frustrating. So I started graduate school and joined the project that was building Alice 2. And the idea behind this was essentially we had spent a lot of time watching people just get killed by the fact that capital B bunny was different than lowercase b bunny, and that 1 divided by 4 equals 0, not 0.25. And all of these things that were just related to the syntax and not being able to match parentheses appropriately, and we just decided that was enough. It was gonna have to go away. And so we spent a bunch of time and actually created this drag and drop based editor, and what's going on here is there's a bunch of method tiles over here. Hopefully I will not advance my slides while I do this. And you create a programming statement by picking up one of these tiles, dropping it in the code editor, and then selecting the parameters. And we also have, you know, if statements and loops and parameters and variables and all the sort of normal things that you would get. But they're all done in this drag and drop kind of way so that people don't actually make syntax errors early on. And so what this program does, we have one line that's been created that tells the chicken to move forward a meter, and then a line that we're in the process of creating that's going to tell the chicken to turn right by one revolution. And so when you play this, it pops up this world with a 3D chicken in it, and the chicken moves forward and turns around. Very exciting. But it turns out that among students who already think they're interested in computing, this helps a lot. So these are students who are at Ithaca College and St. Joe's University. These were chosen to be sort of student populations that were close to SAT mean averages, so they're not, you know, looking at MIT undergraduates. And we chose the students who were declaring a computer science major but were deemed at risk. And what that means is that they were coming in not ready to take calculus and or they had no programming experience. And so typically they go through, they get a C in their very first computer science class, and only 47% actually stay in the major after that. So we're losing more than half of them in our first semester, which is pretty miserable. And so what we did was to actually give them an experience with Alice either prior to or concurrent with CS1, so half semester class. And if we do that, what they get out of it is sort of an intuition about, you know, here's what an if statement means, here's what a variable is, here's how programs in general flow. And so then when they went into Java, they had this model of here's what a program basically is that they could fit all of the stuff that they were doing in their regular CS1 class into. So if you do that, their grade goes up to a B, and 88% of them actually continue on. So that's nice. But these are students who already wanted to major in computer science. And if you start looking at what segment of the population, so if we increase the percentage of students that are already interested in majoring in computer science, and we make sure that we get more of them, so we never lose, we get that 47% and we turn it into 100%, we're still reaching a maximum of like 1% of the population. So there's this big magenta pie that we're not ever gonna touch if we wait until college to do this. And there's a bunch of research that shows that actually middle school is the time that we need to be reaching out to people, that that's the point at where particularly girls are starting to make decisions about whether or not they're in math and science, but boys too. And so it's a very high leverage window for everyone. So we started user testing this with middle school kids. And this is actually a group of three that came in, and what we had them do was they went through the tutorial and they built some stuff, they were doing really well, and they got through and finished the tutorial and then asked us, okay, well, what are we supposed to do? And what we said was, well, you know, you finished the tutorial, so now I want you to build something really cool to show us. And one of them looked at me and she's like, okay, well, I can make this bunny move around, but why would I want to? This is kind of stupid. And she really just had absolutely no interest after that fact, or after that point. And so this kind of, you know, brings out this in retrospect, very obvious thing, which is that, you know, we can make programming arbitrarily easy for people. We can get rid of all of the hair and the fuzz and the unnecessary frustration. But at the end, if there isn't a really compelling reason for, I want to build this program because, then people still aren't going to do it. And so we started asking ourselves, why should middle school kids program? And what we ended up going for was to try and embed programming in some kind of another motivating context. And the context that we chose was actually storytelling. There are a number of reasons for this. I'm happy to address them offline, but I don't want to spend too much time on it. But we decided to go after storytelling. And so I'm going to break here and actually give you a little sense of that system. So this is called Storytelling Alice, and it's the result of about 2 years and 200 or 300 kids coming through and doing user testing. And the program that I like to build was actually originally built by a 13-year-old. And so I'm going to sort of give you a sense by building the world that she built. So I'm going to start off by adding a couple of characters. So I'm going to add some kids. I'm going to add Kristen and Philip. And I'm going to have them kind of sort of face each other at least a little bit. And then what often happens is, although the main characters are often kids and they serve as the protagonists, there are often some other characters that kind of suggest a direction for how the story ought to go. And in this particular case, this student really liked this lunch lady. So I'm going to add the lunch lady. And I'm going to stick her in the cafeteria. Although, as you can see, there's a whole bunch of different scenes that people can choose from. So we have classrooms and graveyards and the kennel and all sorts of crazy places. So we'll have her face them as well. And so then I go back to the programming view, and I've got a bunch of characters. And if I click on the characters, I can actually get the list of methods that they know how to do. So Philip can cheer, and he can punch people, and he can tie his shoelaces, and he can say things and walk places and so forth. And they'll often do a little bit of exploring in this to just kind of get some ideas. This particular girl found the method attempt to brainwash on the lunch lady and decided that the story that she wanted to build was that these two kids had snuck off to the cafeteria and they were having this private romantic moment and then they get caught by the lunch lady. So I'm going to move the lunch lady a little off to the side here so that she can make her dramatic entrance in a little bit. And I'm going to start by having Philip, excuse me, say, Kristen, we are finally alone, .. And when the girl who wrote this, she actually had a much more developed story that went into this whole thing, and there was motivation, and there was, you know, a whole background on this kind of thing, but the dialogue to do that isn't really going to demonstrate all the programming I want to get across, so I tend to elide it to we are finally alone, .. And I will leave you guys to fill in the right sort of a story to make this work. And so what I want to have is for Philip to actually walk over and kiss Kristen. But if we look at what he currently does, he can, you know, cheer and tie his shoelaces and walk places, but kiss does not appear on this list. But we can teach him how to do it. And so we're going to create a new method. We're going to call it kiss. And we're going to start off by having Philip walk over to Kristen. Typically, he would stop at kind of a conversational distance. That's obviously not going to work too well for kissing. So we're going to set the amount of distance between them to be 0. And then what I want is for him to reach up his arms like he's hugging her. And so what I can do is use some animations, an animation called touch. And so I'm going to say, Philip, touch Kristen. Philip is right-handed, so he's going to touch her left side with his right arm. And then I'm going to copy this multiple times, apparently. And I'm going to have him touch her right side using his left arm. So we have a very basic sketch here. So what I'm going to do is go back to the main method, and I'm going to call kiss. So kiss has become a tile like anything else, so I can just drag it in. And if I hit play, off he goes. Maybe we'll move him a little closer for future runs, so it doesn't take him quite so long to get there. One arm, two arms. He's a little awkward, to say the least. And so what we can do is make this a little bit better by beginning to have him raise his arms at the same time. So I can use a construct called a do together to do that. So I'm going to put both of the touches inside that. And then what I want him to do is actually tilt his head back and forth a couple of times, like he's kissing her. So we're going to go find his head, which is, like most people, attached to his neck. And so I'm going to have him tilt his head a little bit to the left, say by 0.1 revolutions, and then back to the right. And this actually is a nice place to put in a loop, because I want him to do it a couple of times. So I'm going to drag in a loop and have him do this twice, and I'm going to stick these guys inside it. And so now I can play this, except I didn't move him, but we can speed him up a little bit. right. And so we can actually, you know, go back and finish off the story. So we'll have the lunch lady make her appearance from off screen. So she's going to say, what are you doing? And Philip is going to turn around and face her. And the lunch lady is going to come and brainwash him. And we have to actually pick his head, which is a little ridiculous. So the artist who made the lunch lady decided that she didn't really need any knees. So she's a little awkward when she walks. All right. So that gives you a little bit of a flavor for how the system works. And essentially what we had to do was three things to make this possible. The first was that we really needed to have high-level animations that enable social interaction and really encourage it. So people are operating, or users are operating at the level of, this is a person behaving this way, not this is a graphical object behaving this way. The second was that when people are introduced to the system, it has to really tell the story that this is about storytelling. This is about, you know, building a movie, it's like Pixar, and not try and shove people down the, and this is a loop, and here's how a loop works, and this is a do-together, and here's how a do-together works. So we motivate all those things, but we do that in the context of, and here's the story that you're trying to build. And finally, that we needed to actually look at the ways that we can inspire different story ideas. So some kids will actually show up, and they come in, and they've got, you know, 10 ideas that they're ready to just pump out right there. And other kids come in, and they're like, I don't really know what I want to do. I don't have an idea. And so trying to figure out how to help them find an idea and ground it very quickly so that they get started actually programming turned out to be very important. So in generic Alice, or in Alice 2, we had this long-based assumption that all objects were essentially created equal. So a chair was just as important as a person. And when you do that, that leads you to these incredibly generic kinds of actions that objects can do. So objects can move, they can turn and roll, so essentially rotating. They can resize themselves, and they can play sounds. And there are a couple other things, but those are really the core ones that get used. And for those of you who have taken a graphics class, you may find these very familiar. So they're actually somewhat different language for translate, rotate, and scale. Because the words that get used in graphics, if you try and user test them with actual human beings, translate is usually about English to German. Scale is about how much something weighs. And rotate is sort of okay, but it's not the word that people would use in everyday language. But if you start looking at the kinds of stories that people actually want to build, and we spent a long time having kids actually develop storyboards and analyzing the kinds of actions that they wanted and how they would be able to create these things within a reasonable period of time, you discover that these very generic kinds of actions just aren't ever going to cut it. And so Storytelling Alice actually has a different API. So all the generic actions like move and turn and so forth are still there. But in addition to that, we have animations that are designed to help people, you know, say things and locomote so they can walk places, they can, you know, sit on things and lie down and kneel and so forth, they can look at stuff. So the actions are much more, this is a person behaving in this way, and the ability to create social interactions is much, much more readily available. So we spent a while also trying to figure out how to springboard stories. And one of the ways that we found to do this was to actually provide custom animations in the story that really require some sort of, or custom animations in the gallery, excuse me, that really require some sort of an explanation within the story. And so this came about actually with this character, Harold T. Wyerton, who had this animation called Crazy Go Nuts. And people would find Crazy Go Nuts and they would immediately have an end to their story. Harold goes crazy. And they would have a question. Well, why did Harold go crazy? And they would use it in very, very different ways. So I failed a test, and I'm really upset about it. My boyfriend has just broken up with me, and I have no idea what to do. I've been, you know, waiting to go to this amusement park for 75 years, it seems like, and now my parents have just grounded me. And they would come up with all these very different explanations that were often very tied into their personal lives to ground how these stories were. And so we found these animations that really require an explanation to be very, very helpful. And so the Lunch Lady Brainwashed animation is another one of these. So you saw the quote from the girl who had just created the bunny tutorial. So the bunny, this tutorial had the bunny, and he would sort of slide around, and he would bang his drum, and that was the extent of the tutorial. And it was designed to teach both actions happening together and looping actions. And you get the response, well, I can do this, but why on earth would I want to? And so what we found was that it was really necessary to have the tutorial actually involve the kids in telling a story. So this is the second tutorial now. And what happens is this fairy on the left decides that she wants to create trouble in the world. And so she casts a spell on this boy, Trevor, and Trevor falls in love with the ogre. And the process of going through the tutorial, you're actually building this story step by step, which is not entirely without consequence. One of the reasons that we tend to go towards very simplified examples and tutorials is because you are then creating many, many fewer opportunities for people to do the wrong thing and hang themselves. And so one of the problems was that we really had to make it so that when people went to these much more complex examples where there were more objects, more places that they could mess up and put the screen into some state that they had no idea how to recover from, we had to prevent them from doing that. And so what we did was to develop this interaction technique, which is called stencils. And essentially what's going on here is that you have the real running interface, and then we're going to draw a stencil over top of it. And the stencil actually intercepts all of the mouse and keyboard events. And so if I, you know, go and click on this Add Objects button, which is below this stencil, nothing will happen because it's getting intercepted. But then you can cut holes through the stencil just in places where that particular step requires it. And so by doing this, you can both, you know, very carefully guide people's attention so that they actually notice the things that you want them to notice in the interface, but also prevent them from making mistakes that would cripple their progress. And so that actually, you know, makes it possible. So you do all these things, and then you're left with this other question. Well, does this actually really matter? Does this make it more compelling for people? So we ran a study that looked at just the storytelling focus. So we created two versions of the system, one we called Generic Alice and one we called Storytelling Alice. Obviously, you can't rock into a user study and say, you guys are going to be the Storytelling Alice kids and you guys are going to be the Generic Alice kids, because you create bias by doing that. So we called them Alice Blue and Alice Green. But what they did was keep the mechanical supports for programming constant. So both of them were using the same drag and drop based interface, so there was no syntax difference. And we used a whole bunch of Girl Scouts. This was done at Carnegie Mellon, so it was within the Pittsburgh area. And what we wanted to do was to make sure that we actually got a very representative segment of kids, not just the kids who thought they were interested in computers and not just the kids who thought they were interested in movies. And so what we did was to use it as a way for troops to raise money for the troop. And so most of the kids who came in were coming in because they wanted to go to New York, or they wanted to go on a ropes course, or they wanted to hire a museum docent for a tour, and not because they particularly wanted to do this activity. And so that allowed us to really ask the question, does this work better for all kids, not just kids who think they're interested in computers? So the structure here was they came in, these were done in 4-hour workshops on usually Saturday afternoons, and they would go through and they would complete the tutorial in the version that they were assigned to. They would then take a programming quiz and an attitude survey. Then they'd have half an hour to try the other version. So they're having 2 hours and 15 minutes in the main version, half an hour in the other version. Then they get to pick one of the two to take home and finally show a world to everyone. I'm not going to go through all of the results on this, but I'm going to sort of try and give you a flavor of the ones that I think are the most interesting. So fundamentally, we have three activities in Alice. There's scene layout, so adding objects, moving around, positioning them, essentially interior decoration, or exterior decoration, I suppose. It's an outdoor scene. The second is actually editing the program, so adding lines of code, changing parameters, adding programming constructs, that kind of thing. And the third is actually running them. And so if you're trying to create a programming experience for someone, you really want their attention to be focused on two and three, not one. And so one of the nice things is that we actually saw a shift towards more programming and less other stuff. So the generic Alice kids actually spent almost twice as much time doing scene layout, and the storytelling Alice kids spent correspondingly more time actually programming and then testing their programs. More interestingly, we can actually start to delve down into the behavior of individual kids. And this I've put up is just the generic Alice kids, because they're green. And what I want you to notice is this cluster up at the top. So at the very extreme here, we have a girl who has spent 97% of her time on scene layout. She added exactly one line of code. She never played it. As a programming experience, this is a total failure. Although she still, you know, reported having a great time with the system. She thought it was awesome. But as a programming experience, we have failed her. So what I'm going to do now is add in the storytelling Alice kids. And what you'll notice is they all come in this area where they're not doing all programming, but they're all doing a very healthy amount of programming. And so what we have here is these two very distinct clusters. And so even within the first couple of hours of programming, I mean, these are kids who have never programmed before. This is their first 2 hours, essentially. We can see learning differences if we look at them by clusters and how much time is actually spent. So I'm going to call these purple people the interior decorators and the yellow guys the programmers. And so we actually see a fairly strong learning effect there. My favorite one, though, is that all of the versions, both versions of generic Alice and storytelling Alice, actually log all of the actions that people take at every point in time. And so that allows us to do some things like, oh, it's break time. Go out into the hall, get a drink of water, go to the bathroom, stretch your legs, talk to your friends, and then look at the percentage of kids who actually sneak back to keep programming. And so with generic Alice, we get about 17%. With storytelling Alice, that goes up to 51%, which we're talking about middle school girls here, is a pretty significant thing. Sadly, this isn't enough either. So it's nice that we can, you know, get them and have them spend their first couple of hours and have a good experience, and they go home really enthusiastic. And then what? So meet my fictitious friend Ashley. This is a very representative thing to have happen, though. So Ashley goes, she downloads Storytelling Alice. She has her, you know, she builds a very small story. She sort of gets this initial boost in confidence. I can do this, this is really cool, I'm really excited about it. And then she takes this ridiculous leap. She goes from this small story to I'm plotting my Shakespearean epic awesome story. And she builds a little part of it and gets stuck. And then what? So sadly, for most middle school kids, there just aren't really good avenues for help. There aren't very many kids. If you look at sort of, you know, a typical average American kid anywhere, most of them are not going to have a parent or a friend who is a computer scientist or has any computer science training. So for the typical kid, a parent or a friend is not a good avenue for help. Computer science isn't in the middle school curriculum, and there are very, very few teachers that have any programming experience either, because it's not something that our national system values. So there isn't really a good avenue for, if your parents don't know, ask your teacher. And you can do the internet search, and you might find something that may be sort of relevant, but the probability that you're going to find, you know, a tutorial that relates exactly to what it is that you want to do is low at best. So we're sort of in a bind here. And so this is sort of the next chapter. We're starting to build a new system that we're going to call Looking Glass. And the real focus in this system is on enabling kids to use programs that they find written by other kids to teach themselves in very effective ways. But we're also going to, you know, make sure that we hang on to all the motivation that has come from storytelling and social interaction. And we actually have some research that's going on to look at making better procedural models based on this learned motion library as well. So we're going to have, hopefully, a more expressive place or more expressive space that people will be able to build stories in, and then really focus on, if I can find an example, I can actually learn from that. So I want to sort of paint a picture of how that might work. So this is a kid with a very long nose who is starting to craft a story about the day that the substitute teacher came and the class revolted and decided to punish the substitute teacher by throwing paper airplanes. And they're not really sure how to do that. So what they do is they go and they find, they go and search through this archive of different stories that other kids have created, and they can't quite find throwing a paper airplane. But what they do find is this example story where this guy was throwing a toy for his dog. And throwing a toy for your dog and throwing a paper airplane, you may want to change the speeds a little bit, but there are a lot of things about those motions that are going to be very similar. So let's suppose that there was some way where, you know, this is, could actually be a fairly lengthy story. This guy might, you know, get up and have a fight with his parents and then go to school and take a test and then finally go to the park and actually throw the toy for his dog. It could be a very small section of a much larger story. And so we have to be prepared for that. So there has to be tools that allow people to actually figure out where the relevant sections of code are. And then once we've actually identified these pieces, we have to be able to help them to adapt them to their own context. At the moment, we have just sort of gotten our very first NSF grant, which covers this piece. And so I'm going to spend most of my time talking about that. And so I want to paint sort of an overall picture of how this is going to work, and then I'm going to delve into how to help people find, how to help novices find code in unfamiliar programs. So there's this prerequisite on this whole situation, which is that we're going to be recording all the high-level user interface actions as people build their programs. We're going to have this history of all the things that were done at a high level. So we're not talking about, you know, mouse move X, Y. We're talking about, okay, I've clicked and dragged on the, you know, pedal beam web walk to tile. I've dropped it on, you know, the in the top position of the scene one method, and I've chosen these values from the parameters. So once we have that, we essentially have the property that when you post a program to this online repository, which will exist at some point, but not tomorrow, every program that gets posted will have knowledge of how it was built. So it knows essentially how to build itself again. And then what we do is we start to look at tools that help people isolate just the section that they want. So this is an example where we have a whole crowd of people who you probably can't see. They're sitting on the bleachers, and they're looking at the coach. And so this, you know, might be used in another story where somebody had just done something embarrassing, and so the entire class turns to look at them. So we just want that section. Then once we have that section, we also have the whole history of how that particular section of code was created. So this tile was dragged here, this parameter value was changed, and we may want to actually filter some of those out. So if you've gone through and you've, you know, tried 1 and then 7 and then 5 and then 3 and then 6, probably we just want to give you the final value on those things. So we can constrict those a little bit. But we can take that, and what we can do is actually to build a tutorial from it that looks much like our Stencils tutorials from previously. And so here's the section of code, and now we're going to walk you through building it in your own context. And what we hope to be able to do is, you know, allow you to change the characters and the objects that you're working with and so forth in some semi-intelligent way. And then because people will have actually built these things themselves, they have a head start on being able to understand how to go about modifying them. And you can imagine inserting particular things. So if this is the, you know, this is the first time this person has seen a loop, maybe you don't want to have them just create loop 3. You want to have them create loop 2 and loop 5 and then loop through 3 just so you get the ability to sort of hammer home, this is about doing this set of actions the number of times that's in this box. And so we can insert things like that to try and clarify those issues. All right, so this problem all by itself, how we actually help people who have absolutely no programming experience at all, localize, you know, this is the, these are the five lines I'm interested in, is actually kind of hard. So we started this off by just asking the question, how do novice programmers approach finding code in unfamiliar programs? This is actually a joint work with one of my PhD students, Paul Gross. And so, you know, we did the initial literature search. There's been a bunch of stuff that looks at how do professional programmers go and navigate through code. And sometimes even how do people who have taken a class or two go and navigate and try and find certain things. But what we're really interested in is what is the person who has completed, you know, a half an hour tutorial and has absolutely no other experience? How do we make this work for them? And so there's a preliminary question even, which is what are the properties of, you know, when they go and they find this dog or guy throwing a toy for his dog program on the web, what is that likely to look like? And what problems are we going to get just from the programs that people find on the web that we're going to need to be able to handle? So we went and did this survey. We found, you know, 15 randomly selected programs, and we started to look at the properties of those things. So there was a wide range of number of lines of code, ranging from about 50 to about 500. The average was 125. And to a computer scientist, that sounds like, oh, these are all very small programs. But to somebody who's written one three-line program, and that's the sum total of their programming experience, 50 lines is really intimidating, and 500 lines is just beyond daunting. They also tend to have a very large number of objects. They tend to have ridiculously poor naming conventions, so somebody will start something in one way, and then they'll change what their story is halfway, and the method name will never reflect that, or they'll add something in that has nothing to do with what they originally called it because it's a convenient place to put it, and those things can really cripple people. And there's a lot, this is probably in part a property of the animation space, but there's a lot of concurrency. So you create a scene and you have a whole bunch of characters doing things at the same time. There are a lot of threads that people have to deal with that things can be happening in. So we took this and some sort of informal observations of people doing a few little code search tasks informally and created this list of design dimensions that tried to cover the space of these are the issues that we think that people are gonna have to deal with. And from those, I mean, these sort of varied along the dialogue could perhaps be a very strong cue, so maybe we'll have some with a bunch of dialogue and some with none. So we'll have to see what people do when there isn't dialogue to rely on. Things like, you know, very long programs and shorter programs and so forth. We took this and we constructed a set of four worlds that tries to cover this space well, so we could understand the mechanisms that came into play. And the way we're expecting this to happen is somebody downloads something, they watch it, and then essentially, based on that output, they're gonna form their goal. I want that part where he's like picking up the banana, yeah, that thing right there. Not anything based on, you know, they may have absolutely zero knowledge of the API, they have no idea how anything is built, they don't really know where to start, they just have this thing right here. And so we tried to construct the tasks in ways that mirror this. We ended up with two different types. The first is a bounding task, where we ask people to find the beginning and end of a particular block of section of code. And the second one actually asked them to make a very, very simple modification. So it didn't involve adding any code or deleting any code, but just changing a parameter value often. And there's obviously the potential for bias when you describe, you know, here's the section. I want the section where the fish turns around and does three backflips, right? The language that you use to describe how that works obviously is going to bias what they're going to go searching for in the actual program. So to avoid that, what we did was actually to capture these little videos and to put the part that we wanted them to find in this red box. So this is actually a screen captured view. We faded out the other characters so they're a little bit less prominent. And then we've put this red box around what this fish is doing. And so that's the way that the tasks get specified. We're 5 tasks for each of the 4 programs. Eventually, this will be starting to look at what kids do. But at the moment, we elected to go with adults initially, in part because 7th graders will only suffer but for so long. And we were pretty sure that this was going to be a pretty frustrating task for people. And adults have sort of learned to persist for a while, and so we felt like we were going to get better data from them. So we had 14 adults. 12 of them had absolutely no prior programming experience whatsoever, which is exactly what we wanted. And 2 of them had had some very, very limited experience long enough in their past that they felt it was no longer in any way relevant. And based on their behavior, it was not in any way relevant. They performed no better than anyone else. So they come in, they take this quick survey, which essentially allows us to make sure that they're not really CS2 students in disguise. They did a bunch of the tutorials so that we get them up to speed on how things work, how do you add a line of code, how do you navigate through the system, and just sort of a basic set of things. They completed then 1 practice task in each of the 2 types, so they did 1 bounding task and 1 modification task, and then they get as many code search tasks as they can done in the period that they have. And what we collected from this was we actually have video and audio of the subject, and then we screen captured what they were actually doing, so we get a pretty good picture of the session. As you might expect, this is pretty ridiculously hard for a lot of people. So in the end, we only got 41% of them getting correct answers on these things. And some of the answers took, you know, more than 20 minutes to actually get to. And this was sort of a psychologically hard study to run because, you know, people come in, they're happy, they're enjoying life, and by the end of the 2 hours, they're miserable. And so it was not, you know, it's not the case that just 20 minutes is like, oh, that's kind of a long time. It was a very, very frustrating 20 minutes for a lot of people. This is not the kind of thing that they would ever have even begun to do if there wasn't somebody breathing down their neck. But we can take that experience and apologize to each of them individually, and then build sort of a model of how they go about it and use that to inform better tools. So essentially, they're operating in 2 spaces. They've got the space of the output, so this can either be the video that they've watched or the output of the program, and they've got the code. And so what they do is they start off by watching the video, and they notice some things. They go into the code, and then they sort of start looping back and forth between these 2 things. I'm going to lump the video and the output of the program into just output, because they could go back and forth between either of them. They spend some time in this loop. They figure out some things, and eventually they generate a solution. But what's really going on here, if you actually start watching these people, as they watch the actual output, they're noting things. The centaur moves. Oh, the cage is shaking back and forth. The teddy bear falls down. And these are actually the things that they're going to go and try and search for in the code. So we're going to call these things landmarks. And what they're trying to do is take these landmarks and actually form mappings where they have an idea of, you know, here's the actual line of code that is associated with this landmark. These may be right, they may be totally wrong, but they actually try and form these mappings. And so actually as we go through this process, they're going through the video, they're noting a bunch of landmarks that are gonna form the sort of core of their search. Then they go back into the code, they look for those landmarks. They may form some mappings. They may actually identify some other landmarks in the code, things that, oh, the fish is turning around, so I should check in the video and see if the fish is turning around. So they'll actually go both directions. And eventually, hopefully, they get to the point where they have enough mappings that they've identified with relatively high confidence the section of code that they're looking for, and so they generate a solution. And there are some failure cases, which I'm going to skip. Internally, what's going on is you can actually view this as a big set. So there is a set of landmarks that they've noticed in the output, and there is a set of landmarks that they've noticed in the code. And essentially what they're trying to do is to have these sets converge. And so the intersection between them is the place where they've actually started to form some mappings. In this process, they may actually exclude both landmarks from the output and landmarks from the code. So I know this happened earlier. This is not part of what I'm looking for, so this isn't. I'm not going to bother trying to map this one. This says the fish is, you know, doing some crazy action, and I know he doesn't do that based on the video, so I'm going to ignore this one too. Similarly, there can be included mapping, so I know this is part of the target that I'm looking for, and I've mapped this thing, and I've actually excluded it. It's not part of what I'm looking for. Individually, if we dig down into what a particular search looks like, there's often a basic process that people tend to go through. So we've identified some landmarks. We go and kind of scan for those. And that can either be, you know, a very solid text matching. So this guy says this text string, so I'm looking for this text string. Or it can be sort of a vague description of, well, he's kind of turning around and shaking some things. And so I'm going to look for something that looks like it might turn him around and shake some things. Often that's done in just the current code context, so whatever the thing is that's currently selected in the code editor. If that fails, then what often happens is they'll try and establish some time bounds on things. So I know it happened after this point, I know it happened before this point. If that works and they actually get time bounds, then they may redo their scan just within things they've identified as being active during that point. If they can't, this is usually where increasing frustration starts to hit, they'll start doing an exhaustive search of every piece of code that they can identify. Based on this, eventually they get to the point, hopefully, where they've made a mapping. Not everybody actually got to that point all the time. But once they've made a mapping, then they switch to sort of an anchored search. So I know that this line of code, or I believe I know that this line of code corresponds to this action. So I'm going to look at things before and things slightly after to try and confirm that this is the section I'm looking for, or to confirm that it's not the section I'm looking for. That's kind of the optimistic case, where things are sort of going well. There's also the, I just can't find anything. So for the first few times that happens, what they'll do is go back to the output and try and generate a new set of landmarks and start this process again. Once they feel like they've exhausted the set of rational things to look for, there are a couple of just true desperation measures. One of them is starting to look at the API for a particular character. I know I'm looking for the pig who's doing something, so I'll just go look at what the pig knows how to do, and hopefully that will trigger something. There usually isn't a solid strategy associated with that. It's more of a, well, maybe this will trigger something that might be helpful. And then once that fails, not everyone knows to do that. But if that fails, then what they'll often go to is, I'm just going to start randomly clicking around this interface. And maybe something will come up that will give me a clue. They're not happy people by this point. So there are a couple of very specific challenges that come out of this that are things we can address within the programming environment. So very specifically, building these mappings is ridiculously inefficient because we're requiring people to be in two totally separate spaces. So we have the output, and they can watch that, and then they have what the code is, and they're just two different worlds. And we don't have really good ways for them to build correspondences. These are total beginners, right? They don't really have a solid understanding of a method can contain other actions, or this construct behaves in this way. And so, particularly with methods, they may miss sections of code that are executing that actually contain the thing that they're looking for because they don't really, you know, it's in a code editor. Things all sort of look similar. And so telling the difference between, we actually gave them a primer on, you know, here's how to tell the difference between something that has stuff in it and something that doesn't. But that model of this has stuff in it isn't really there. And so even if you tell them here's how to get to it, it's not something that comes out very easily. The programming constructs can also be a problem because they don't really understand how they work, and so they can lead them to make incorrect deductions about what's happening at one point in time. or they may actually notice the inconsistency. This is particularly true with large-scale do-together kinds of things, where it's like, I've found this thing, and I know this happens at the end of the story, and this thing down here, well, it seems to happen at the beginning of the story, so there's no order to this thing at all. I have no idea what happens when. It's clearly not in order. And they will also very strongly include or exclude things based on the naming of the method. So if I say this is about the coach doing a backflip and there happens to be something else in there, they won't ever look there because it's about the coach doing a backflip. And this is not something that we can control directly, because the real play here is that we want any program that anyone creates to be a resource, which means that we have to be able to get them around this. We can't require that when you submit a program, it has the following properties. All right, so, I'm going to break here. We've been working on a tool to try and help people do this a little bit better. This is very early. We're still actually actively user testing it. And so it's a little preliminary. It takes a second to come up. So this is actually an early version of Looking Glass as well. So I'm going to open the same program that we had built as a demo earlier. And so the way we envision this happening is because you're actually looking for things based on the output, what you're going to do is you're going to run the program. And in this particular case, maybe I'm building another scene where I want two characters to kiss. So I'm interested in how that action works. So I'm going to play until after the action that I'm interested in is completed. So I'll wait for the lunch lady to actually say something. And then I'm going to stop and explore what happened. And what this is going to do is it's going to bring up an interface that gives me kind of an interactive history. So what's going on is that we've been screen capturing exactly what the world looks like at, you know, as frequently as we can, and also recording a trace of what's actually executing by intercepting the virtual machine. And so what we can do is actually help people to make deeper connections between what's actually going on. So there are a number of ways this can happen. Often, you know, people who have just gone through the initial tutorial tend to be very focused on the code because this is the familiar part of the interface. And so for them, what they may do is say, oh, well, kiss looks reasonable. So I'm going to select kiss. Oh, and look, there's this button over here that I can explore it. Well, I can also actually play it. And so I can see, hopefully, it may have just crashed on me. I apologize. Curse of the very first public demo. I apologize. So we'll get back, hopefully, to that point. It was working beautifully this morning when I tested it. So I can actually play just an individual animation. So if I go to kiss, I can play this and actually see what this animation did. And I can also jump into more details. So I can say, OK, I played this. This actually has more than I want. I just really want the actual kissing action. So I'm going to explore into this. And then I can see the individual pieces one at a time. So I can actually play just the touch motion and see him raise his arms. I can actually play just the looping motion and see what that looks like. I can actually dive into what the loops do, and I can see the individual components one at a time. So this, you know, moves his head to the left, and this moves it back to the right. And so I get a much tighter integration of this is the thing that's causing this. What you can also do is to identify things based on just dragging through this slider. And so it'll actually highlight the thing that's executing over here so we can get back to say, and it'll show me that this is the thing that's going on. I also have this panel here. This is a sort of simplified case because there's really only one thing happening at any one time, or one character active. But in a more typical story, what you'll have is a lot of different people doing things. And so, you know, what's in this window may not be the right context. And so what we have over here is the, you know, this is everything that was going on at 1.88 seconds. And it's organized by character because that's how people actually state what they're looking for. I'm looking for the pig doing this kind of an action. I'm looking for Kristen doing this kind of an action. And so you can filter these things based on, I'm just looking for this character. And so there are also tags here for being able to jump into and edit those things. So if we get to KISS, we can jump into KISS this way as well. So there are a number of things that this is really doing. So one of them is that it's trying to make a much tighter connection between the code and the output, both from, you know, here's how the scene appears at this point, here are the things that are actually connected to it, and when you're actually looking at the code, here are the things that are currently executing, and the ability to actually play them. One of the significant things is just, you know, knowing which things can be opened and which things can be poked into further. And so adding these buttons both in the code pane and also in the actions pane sort of help direct people towards, this would be a good place to look. Sometimes, obviously, you can get to traces that are a little bit overwhelming. So this is one from one of the study worlds, and it has the burly pig is doing something, and there's a fairy who's doing something, and there's a centaur who's doing something, and there are a couple other characters, and they're all doing things at the same time. But you can then filter these things based on, I'm just interested in what the burly pig is doing. And the ability to actually play these things, what we're starting to see is that people will actually go through and start building up an understanding of what the programming construct is just by being able to pull things apart this way. So when we're running this, the user test for this, what we're having them do is the very, very first tutorial, which essentially has them add 3 lines of code, and that's it. They don't see do-togethers, they don't see loops, they have no idea what methods are, nothing. And then we're asking them to sort of pull apart these things. And as they can say, you know, it's like, oh, well, I can play this loop, and here's what this does, and I can break it down and actually see what this action's doing, then we're starting to see people actually forming a, you know, okay, well, I understand a loop actually goes through and does whatever inside it, however many times you tell it to do that, which is sort of a nice thing to see. And we're seeing a similar sort of thing, I guess I've lost a slide, in terms of the methods. So the whole notion of, you know, attempt to brainwash is an animation which has other animations inside it that are things that you can control may want to pay attention to. And so we're seeing people start to understand that, oh, okay, this is an action which has more details that I can edit. And so building up an intuition that these are the way that constructs works. So we're at the point where we're doing the final sort of bits of user testing on this and getting it really solid, and then starting to do formal evaluation of it. I'm also really actually intrigued by what we're starting to see happen with people just beginning to pick up, you know, here's what a do-together does, and here's what a loop does, without anyone actually telling them. They're not getting that information from any textual source or any teacher or anything. They're just figuring it out. And so I think there's some interesting questions in, well, can we, you know, often people learn electronics by pulling apart, you know, clock radios and toasters and so forth. Can we have a similar sort of situation where people learn the basics of programming by pulling apart other people's programs? And then we have to actually get the point where we can connect all of the, you know, here's the code that's been selected, and we're going to actually generate the tutorial from this. So I think I'm going to do this very, very quickly and then stop. This is not the only context in which this matters. So this is actually my graduate student's brother-in-law, who has started his own web business selling t-shirts that are about St. Louis. And so he decided that he was going to build a web page for his company. And so he went off and he searched the web and he found some example web pages that exhibited features that he wanted for his web page. And so ideally, he'd be able to do this himself, but his actual strategy was to call Paul and say, here, I want this feature on my web page. Can you pull it out for me? So for the rest of the world that does not have a PhD in computer science relatives, The same notion of being able to record what things look like for a lot of end-user programming environments, there isn't as much just go out and compute this value and do some calculation on it and get some answer back, which doesn't really work well in this strategy. There's a lot of the interface changes in this way, this observable value changes in this way. And so we can imagine having the same sort of, you know, I'm going to interact with a web page and I'm going to record that interaction. And then I'm going to go through that history and actually pull apart, here's what was interacting at that point in time. There are a ton of these things out there now. You know, Photoshop has scripting, Excel does some as well. There's lots and lots of web stuff. And all of these kinds of environments could potentially benefit from people's ability to more directly connect these things. And so I think I'm going to actually stop there. Happy to take questions if people have them. So it turns out the translation of actions, at least at the initial level, is not really an issue. And we've, you know, as a sort of culture, we've developed a lot of just language things from walk over to Dr. Ryder, walk over to that chair and sit down in it. And so almost all of the instructions that you would give another person are relative to some other object. And so the animations are also that way. We tell you, you know, you don't say, move forward by this much and then turn left a little bit and then move forward by this other amount. You say walk over to this target. And so that gets rid of a lot of it. But certainly the notion of having body syntonic motions is a very appealing one. And one of the ways that we start to teach people about how to use things like move and turn when you want to actually create a particular motion on a body part is by, you know, demonstrating arm circles. So, you know, forward arm circles go this way, and backwards arm circles go this way. And you can actually have people stand up and start to act through some of those kinds of things. But the first barriers are really about how do you actually write a program, and what does the interface do, and what can I expect the output to do, and what exactly is going on here, not about how do I specify the motion. It's the kind of thing that comes in much later. We weren't really very well set up to do a longitudinal study, so I don't have formal data that speaks to that. I've certainly heard from some of them, you know, and some of the Girl Scout troop leaders would email me months later and say, my kids are still using this. So there's certainly some persistence after the fact. I don't think it's everyone. I think the scenario that we're painting where you know, you hit some barrier and can't actually get around it is a fairly significant thing. But one of the advantages of moving to this space where anything can be an example and there is this web community is that it should set us up to be able to answer some of the questions about persistence over a longer period of time in a way that actually gives us much more broad data as well. So it won't just be, you know, these individual 80 kids. It'll be, we can actually look at Storytelling Alice has been downloaded somewhere between 50,000 and 100,000 times. That's a lot of people. And it's a lot more than the 80 we can touch independently. And so if we can start setting up the community and then be able to look at their behavior over time, I think we get a much richer data set. So that's the long-term plan on that. So I think the strategy that we're really going for is to isolate the pieces that they really have to understand. One of the problems that is really daunting to, you know, it's like, I've just downloaded this 100,000 line mega ridiculous situation, and now I'm trying to figure out the high level, you know, theory of how this thing was built, and maybe there's skeleton code in there, by which I mean something that was built and was at one point functional but is no longer, but has never been removed and is ridiculously misleading. I think by being able to sort of tie, like, this is what you're seeing, this is what's actually executing at this point, what we can do is give people a much smaller scope that they feel like they have to understand. And once we've given them a smaller scope and made it so that it's like, I know that this scope is the thing that's relevant, and this is the output that it's controlling, then we make the task of actually building a model between those much, much simpler. And then once you have that piece, you can start building out from there. But I think if we can help people find a foothold, and I think that's equally true for more experienced programmers as well. So I think some of these things have implications for all of us rather than just the total newbies. But often you learn some good stuff. Quiet story? Okay. So there's a lot in your question. So I'm going to try and pull individual pieces. It's hard to judge. I don't know these kids. I don't have another relationship with them. I see them once when they come in for 4 hours. And so it's hard for me to really judge whether they're being more or less creative than they would in some other context. What is happening is that often the stories that they write have some bearing on something that they're thinking through. So there are a number of stories that have looked at the supposing that I woke up tomorrow and I was the most popular kid in school. what would the ethics of that situation be? So should I try and, you know, make friends with, you know, keep my old friends and bring them along to the popular cluster? Should I try and make friends with the popular cluster and exclude my old friends because they're not cool? And so there's a lot of sort of interesting reasoning going on. People use it to talk about, my parents are going through a divorce, and here's the situation that I'd like to have happen. I think mom and dad should both move out, and they should get apartments close by, and my sister and I, we're going to stay at home and live there. And so they end up writing things that are very grounded in their current lives, which is actually very consistent with one of the things that's going on for middle school kids is that they're really trying to form identities. They're trying to answer the question, who do I want to be as an adult? What is my value system and why? And so they use stories as sort of a way to explore that. There's also a lot of social interaction between people. So, you know, somebody will find something and they'll tap their friend on the shoulder and say, hey, look what I did. And there's a lot of positive that comes from, I built something and my friend laughed at the right point. So I think it's certainly encouraging activity and encouraging creativity. Whether it's encouraging it more or less than other activities that they do is really hard to evaluate from where I sit. But does that answer most of what you brought up?
I think it's